You thought you were scared and sad before. Yeah. And then you get to that part and you're like, oh, I just want to go to bed. Hi, I'm Kat.
And I'm Gabe.
And we're
the Ghouls Next Door. Talking about spooky stuff.
Spooky stuff.
Yes, we are the Ghouls Next Door, a media literacy show from a horror lens where we explore the real life, historical, and societal influences behind our cinematic fears. And we are continuing our horrors of society.
Horrors of society.
Yeah, so we're continuing our Horrors of Society series where we're talking about the spooky things that happen in society.
As it tends to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're very clever with our naming. We say exactly what it's about.
Yes.
Which is that society is stressful. Has been, will continue to be, but also maybe we shouldn't think that as much about individual people. I don't know. We'll end up talking about it. But.
Yeah. Today we're going to be talking about The Mist. It was a first watch for me, not a first watch for Kat. And I know it's like a horror staple. And I probably had seen it just like probably in the beginning. I was like bored of just like grocery store. Before it got
just
to like
normal, yeah,
the monsters or something. I do know like the ending. I know it to be one of the more famous, like worse ending, like not like it was a bad ending, like badly made, bad as in like the worst thing that could happen.
It's just very horrifying, and that like the emotional dread that you feel at the end of the movie is palpable. You thought you were scared and sad before. And then you get to that part and you're like, oh, I just want to go to bed.
Yeah.
That was awful. Like, I'm just sad now. Yeah. And that's okay. I think that's what it wants you to feel. So,
yeah.
Like, mission achieved in that regard.
Nobody wants to be here.
That seems like a bad time.
No thanks. Yeah. I think what's really interesting is if I had. Like, if we had watched this and reviewed it, like, last year, the episode would not be what it is going to be today.
Oh, like, yeah.
We have come into some research and some interesting findings that have, you know, changed the way that we view media like this. And I think that's really interesting. Like, especially because such a big part of us is linking to real things that are happening, or real studies, and the way that the brain works, and people and society. So to learn how society works, how people work, it changes the way that we understand this film.
Yeah, it's like the way the media is made makes a lot of films make a little bit more sense in that why they are positioned the way that they are, because like how we used to feel is like the easy answer, I think. It's what they wanted you to take away from it, you know?
Yeah.
But now I have like a new perspective, which I mean, like both still are like a little bit true, but like definitely a little bit more nuanced than I think we had before.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, you know, I think a part of it is people aren't as bad as we say they are, but also there are people who are pretty bad. Right?
Yeah.
There are people who would really thrive in an environment where there's no more rules, and they would find it as this opportunity to finally break free and, you know, abuse the power they might find themselves in. And for sure. But I think the important thing to remember is that that's like the minority. Most people are not going to do that.
Yeah, and if anything, like, in feeling that they are going to do the bad stuff, like, and not giving them a chance to not do the bad thing, you're kind of manifesting that would happen. Like, in the sense that, like, you're saying, oh, that's trash. And then people are going to try to be trash because you're not having faith that they could be doing a different thing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it has to do with like belief and like feeling like trusting people and building community. And it's like, I thought being a hermit was like what I needed to be doing. And now I actually feel slightly differently. And that's stressful because that sounds like a lot of work.
To be different.
Yeah. And also just like talk to people. I don't know more. But it's okay.
Yeah.
It's necessary if we want to survive spider apocalypse, which I don't know if I do, but
yeah,
still.
Well, it's like, like you were saying right before we started recording, was like, you don't even go to the grocery store.
Yeah, you will not catch it. Post-pandemic, I exclusively Instacart, and I tip well because they have to suspect themselves to that. Mm-hmm. And it sounds awful. And I know how awful it is to be in a grocery store as a neurodivergent human. It is one of the most stressful things on the list of things you have to do on the daily. So, like, yeah, no, I exclusively like Instacart. Because it's a lot. I don't like to go to the store. And I remember when we were watching, I was like, you know, this is why I Instacart.
Yeah. Because
I do not want to be there.
Yeah.
It seems awful. Trapped outside my house. No.
Yeah. I definitely Instacart, but I also, as an extrovert, really like going outside. I like going into the store.
I know, okay.
I like being there. I want to see stuff. Yeah, I mean, it could still be stressful. Like some people just be really wild in the stores, just acting up. Especially, I mean, like we just recently had a water fear with our water quality here in Philly.
People
were crazy about buying all this water, this bottled water, and then it was okay. And then all these stores to accommodate that rush bought a bunch of water, and then there was just like a bunch just sitting there, and it was like, no, just go give that to people who need it. So because there's an illusion of scarcity always. Mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of the whole thing, right? Is like there's all these illusions of the way that society will react, and so then we are told that's what people are gonna do. So when it when things happen, we're like, of course,
that's what,
like,
we people are going
to
do
things,
yeah.
So I have to, you know, be ready for when all the horrible things that people are expected to do are going to do. And it's like, no, actually, people are chill. People are chill.
They're chill till you tell them they're not chill. Then they're stressed.
Yeah. Knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't I hop in and tell you about this film?
Do it.
So, we are talking about The Mist from 2007, and it is about a freak storm unleashes a species of bloodthirsty creatures on a small town, where a small band of citizens hole up in a supermarket and fight for their lives. And it is directed by Frank Darabont and written by him and Stephen King, based on a Stephen King short story, which I do want to read. I am interested in. I do take most King books with a grain of salt. As far as like, I have to like prepare myself emotionally for what is probably going to upset me. And not because like, ooh, it's spooky. It's just like he has a flawed way that he sees the world and people. So he makes some really very questionable decisions looking at you and of it. that maybe we don't need to be.
And we don't do
naked.
That. Yeah.
Why? We didn't need to do that.
I did look up the director, and the reason that everyone from like season one, The Walking Dead, is in this movie is because he also made The Walking Dead.
Well, there you go.
So that answered that question, because I was like, why is every single character from season one in this movie? It's so
true.
Weird.
So, zombies are rarely the monsters we need to worry about. Any horror buff would be thrilled to explain that the real horror of Dawn of the Dead is not the infected cannibals chasing the ragtag group, but rather consumerism, showcased by the unsubtle location at a shopping mall as their safe haven. Romero's zombie threat reaches beyond the act of being devoured and seeps into the fear of losing our individuality. Because what is a zombie but a mindless, shambling person driven only by instinct, stripped of anything that makes them unique or able to make their own decisions. We've definitely talked about this many times on The Ghouls. Romero himself said that the zombie is a sympathetic character, having once been a person, a loved one even, and now reduced to impulse and monstrosity. We watch horror for the thrill of the chase, pursued by human or otherworldly monsters, and the eventual triumph of our heroes. Something we've discussed often is that horror can be this cathartic experience that allows viewers to work through their own fears, fears that have faces like self-doubt and oppression, because it's not, again, it's not the monster. And then they get to conquer them. And it they ultimately reduce this monstrous fear into a sizzling pile of blood and goop. And that's really pleasant. It just feels victory. Nice to not have to deal with that anymore. So whether vampire, zombie, ghoul, or tentacle beast, we can agree that these monsters aren't what we should fear, but instead the society that survives these encounters, because people come out of it ultimately changed, right? And some will argue they become what they were always supposed to be, or what they were always were underneath who they made themselves out to be. King would definitely argue that. And a society created out of disaster and horror, made up of terrified and scarred individuals, must also be something to fear. It is often the people that are more terrifying than the zombies, especially in like any of these films. But like 28 Days Later, like the most terrifying scene is not the zombies chasing them.
It's the military time, yeah.
Yes, 100%. So, and then it just like kind of puts it all into it just reaffirms this belief that that's what you should fear. And absolutely, like, people are dangerous and they will jump at an opportunity. And they do it now, right? Like Kat explained it too. People don't need the apocalypse or the rules to be gone to commit these horrible acts if they are already capable of doing them. They don't need an excuse. And so when we monstrousize villains or like bad people, it separates us from them, as Kat has mentioned, and especially in our Swarm episode, right? Mm-hmm. So Stephen King's The Mist is such a disaster society. The film and short story follow townsfolk trapped in a grocery store after a mist descends upon the town. And this mist proves itself more ominous than first believed, housing monstrous beings with tentacles, skittering bugs, and worse, skull-patterned spiders that lay eggs inside of you.
Worst thing in the entire
the
world.
It's the worst.
The whole movie could have been that, and I would have been like, sold.
Yeah.
I don't want to be there. Yep, you got me.
Yeah, you're right. Forget society. I don't even.
I didn't know this was my nightmare. It is.
Yeah. yeah, I was like, wow, this is like the scariest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, like actually.
I was still afraid of being trapped and being in space. Turns out it was afraid of spiders. So all of these are truly and effectively terrifying, stirring in us deep, unspoken fears of these creatures and making our skin crawl with the thought of them. However, this premise is easily survived. Simply stay out of the mist and in the safety of the store. We take care of each other as a community and we survive the night or several nights. Right? It was survivable.
Such a short period of time.
Yes.
They really just had to like stop yelling at each other for a minute.
And we see at some point that there are other people who've survived. So
yeah,
like clearly you just had to hunker down. Like you just had to be nice. So unfortunately, as Kat alluded to, distrust and paranoia reveal themselves early in the disaster. And insidious and poisonous, the group structure plunges into uncertainty and violence. Their secrets and dark histories with each other warp their experiences and push them into desperate, dangerous situations. These actions put them all at risk, proving that the real monsters are your neighbors and not the otherworld demons outside the windows.
Which it's the opposite.
Yeah, but that's just the thing, right? Yeah. King is obsessed with revealing the seedy underbelly of society where everyone is one unfortunate event away from breaking. He lives to spin tales of humanity's supposed true intentions, in quotations. Because are they? So we covered a very long time ago his needful things, which the thesis of is precisely this, that at the heart of every person is a dark secret and desire that they would harm others to achieve. It's just like, yeah. Oh, everyone wants something bad. Do whatever they want to get it. It, though, featuring one of the most notorious monsters in horror, Pennywise, reveals that the real villain is the town of Derry. Ripe with racism and violence that has infected the very soul, this innate evil is what drew the creature to Derry in the first place. He wasn't here just messing things up. He came because it was already evil. Yeah. Which you could definitely hear me talk about at length anytime. So in this case of the chicken or the egg, evil was born long before it was the chicken. Yeah. So The Mist follows the same logic, exploring an innate violence we presumably keep under wraps when normal society has control of us. When Andre Brower's Brent refuses to believe his neighbor David that there are tentacle beasts in the Mist and instead becomes violent, he's so convinced that David and the other white townsfolk are playing with him, it is an expected, though frustrating, moment. We can believe that the tension and toxic history Brent reveals seeps deeper than a lawsuit. Yeah. It's very obvious that he has experienced pain and discomfort of this town made up of predominantly white middle-class people who've weaponized their whiteness against him. And it's like a moment. We had a little tension when we first meet them, and then they're in the store together. We came here together, presumably cleaning up any misunderstandings or the stress they have.
The kid even asked, "Is like, we're cool now?"
Yeah,
I love that. I want us to be cool.
Yeah, because there's a kid. He doesn't have prejudice. So when he has this reaction, it is really frustrating because you're like, we are in a really stressful time. You got to believe people. But it's like, does he? He doesn't. Yeah, he really doesn't. And in that scene, I haven't read the book, so I don't know if that character is Black in the book. But just kind of that tension in him being surrounded by these, like, hick townsfolk who were mean even to David. Like, already, like, because David has money and went to school. So clearly they come from, they're a specific brand of human that probably made Brent feel really uncomfortable. So it's absolutely believable that he will not go into the back room in a time of a disaster and vulnerability with a bunch of white men who he has no reason to trust, like straight up. So that absolutely believable. And that makes sense in that time. But then there's also the terrifying evangelical Mrs. Carmody, who begins preaching the end of times and just claiming that the creature is a murderous mist, is a reckoning, a warning from God that she is at first dismissed for. People are like, oh, crazy lady. And as the rules of society do start crumbling away, leaving a vulnerable and more pliant community in need of guidance, her words of retribution and call for expiation seem reasonable because they're looking for any guidance. And that's what King wants you to think. And that's what the people in power want you to think, is that if we don't have someone telling us what to do and how to behave, we, of course, are going to be bad. People are gonna be so naughty if there's no one to tell them don't do that. That's not how society works. That's not how society has ever worked. We know that. We know historically societies, like any communities, like group of people who came together, they figure it out, they work together, they don't need somebody to hurt them to be a good person. That's not how that works. For them, having this person who gives them an explanation and guidance and a way out and some type of person in power that they can look to, it really just warps the way that they understand the situation. And so it becomes this idea of like, what's one sacrifice for the betterment of their new society? Okay, God wants them to do that. So, but do keep in mind that the film takes place over, what is it, like 4 days? And for King, humanity is one horrific tragedy away from collapse, and it can crumble in less than a week.
Yeah.
That's what he wants you to think. So the film is absolutely effective with its scares, both in the creature design and the viciousness of this community. In particular, a scene that will haunt my nightmares for as long as I can live, finds a young MP officer wrapped in a haunting spider web, and it's slowly revealed that he has been used as a vessel, not for food, but incubation. Yep. It's full of eggs. Which is horrifying. I like want to cry. And during a fight with the grotesque ghostly alien spiders, the MP's body falls from his web cocoon onto the ground, and in true King Horror, because he is very good at it, bursts into 1,000 spiders. Yep. And it's a they're all skittering around. Yep. Just for people, I just want to paint the picture for everyone.
Maybe ever happened. Yeah. Nightmares. Like, 1 million. I like to this day, I'm like, I just want to cry every time I think about it. And I'm going to like give a little blurb about it when we get to my section. But like, I did not know how scared I was of spiders until I saw this movie and I was like, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, if I see like a spider, I'm like, okay, go over there. Like, I'm word respect. But when you see like an egg and like the little sack and then they come out of it, then I'm like, no, stop.
Shush.
But this time it was like a person. It's like, no.
It's like my biggest fear. I think there's like a, the man who does the scary stories with the art that's really scary, Junji Ito.
Yeah.
Ito. I think he has one where a similar thing happens where someone gets spiders laid in their face and then it explodes while they're sleeping.
Scary is that stories. Not him? Scary stories are telling in the dark, isn't it?
When I tell you that haunted me.
And she like picks on her face. Remember Guillermo did that.
Oh, okay, yes, you're so right. I don't know why I thought it was Junji Ito. I guess because he's so good at doing scary stuff like that.
He probably did, to be honest.
But for real, like, when I say, like, I used to have nightmares as a child, waking up covered in spiders, like, no.
Yeah. It was, like, pinnacle horror. Like the tentacles are, like, okay, you can, like, shrug it off, right? It was really gross. It was super gross. It was very triggering for me. Because anything that has, like, the little things for trypophobia is just not for me. And then, like, the bugs were fine. Like, or even, like, the, like, dinosaur-looking creatures. Like, there's, like, all kinds of creatures. It's very interesting. When they got to the spiders, I was like, that's it.
That's it. We're done here. And for 2007, they looked real. You can tell me those things were not actually happening. They were like shockingly convincing and so upsetting. I don't understand. It was 2007. The design graphics were not that good, were they? I don't know.
It was like the whole movie felt like it was full of myths. I'll tell you that. But it like when he fell and he burst into the spiders, I was like, that's it for me. And that's just the thing, right? After that event, that would surely break anyone's psyche.
Yep.
Mrs. Carmody's insane rants of God's punishment absolutely ensnares the community of the store. It makes sense. After you see that, how could you not be like, okay, yeah, God did that. God's really mad.
I don't want to burst into a thing of spiders. You're so right, crazy
like,
lady.
I'm not gonna
you
take the
it.
Chance, right? Like at that point, it's like I don't want to take the chance. Because what if it is God? Because he's a jerk. He does all kinds of terrible things. He would totally put a man full of spiders.
All I'm saying is, if that's what we're doing, me and God are going to meet real soon. You know what I mean? Take me from this world. I do not want to be here if the spider thing happens.
Yes.
No.
Well, Mrs. Carmody, after this event, now has control. Yeah. Of this store, which is like the big premise of it, right? Also, like, religion has a cult mentality to it as well. You need like that community that we talked about. But at the core, it is that idea of like there's someone in charge telling you the answer, because we're all looking for answers.
Yeah,
we're all looking to fit in and we don't want to be here. If this is the way that we stop being here, okay. Right? Yeah. Like that's what it feels like for them. And so her ability to corrupt the minds of this small group is really terrifying as they descend into chants of expiation, which we looked it up. This is like retribution and reparations. Before they end up in their, you know, wild hysteria, stab a young military officer as a sacrifice to her Old Testament God. And it feels very believable in that way. And The Mist is one of the most horrifying films that I've seen in a long time, specifically for that. And because it was believable in that, like, people do get riled up by religion and they're in need of something like that. But I couldn't help but consider the inaccuracies of King and director Frank Darabont's envisioned fallen society after learning some information. So thanks to a very helpful and thought-provoking video by TikTok user Better Strangers Book or Matt Hirschberger, my expectations of these disaster societies have been forever changed. And in the video, he explains that people in the field of disaster studies have found in their research evidence that contradicts King and Darabont's dark world. Which is also interesting because Darabont making The Walking Dead. That's another example of, like, the zombies aren't bad. Like, the walkers are just walking. Sometimes they're just sleeping. They don't matter. It's always the people.
Yeah, it's like people, one, like, the ones that are evil are extra evil. But then the ones that, like, are the good guys have a slow descent. I'm on, like, season 8 now. And they have, like, the slow descent into losing their humanity and then finding it and then losing it and then... Someone's always more evil. It's like such a wild time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, evil people are in there.
King and Darabont are like really believe in or really work well with creating narratives in which people are the villain, even when we're surrounded by something that is obviously a villain, like, but unintentionally a villain. Like, zombies don't know. They're not doing it in this sinister fashion. They don't mean harm. Yeah. They're just trying to live, right?
Yeah.
Or unlive, whatever. but people in, you know? So, yeah. But apparently, when it comes to real life disaster situations where you would expect, because of narratives like this, narratives both fiction and nonfiction, how many news reports do we have that cast the story of people being the true villain and the horror of the story? Apparently, this field of disaster studies was developed to explore the way people would react in the event of disasters such as a nuclear apocalypse so that they could understand how people are going to react to something like that. And then they can quickly come in and restore order because, of course, there's going to be chaos. People are going to go crazy. We got to get in there. We got to fix it.
Yeah.
So they're like, let's figure out what people do so we can, you know, get ahead of that, because the nuclear, like, we're very, very close to midnight, even closer now than we've ever been, obviously. So what they found, however, was more often than not, in disaster situations, humans actually behave quite well. No. The narratives pushed in the media during times of crisis tend to highlight crimes like looting, which occur far less and much less violently than they are reported to be. Also, it's like... That's stuff. That's stuff that we probably need. In fact, any looting that does occur is often from people needing to go to the store during a disaster and finding it closed, or worse, fearing scarcity. So they become desperate for those goods and then take them.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they take
stuff. Honestly, like, when the society collapses, money doesn't need to exist. So just take what you need.
We're gonna be good. And it's like, okay, so someone takes some shoes, like, they probably need those sneakers or whatever. They're just sneakers.
Yeah, it goes with the whole thing. It's like, you see someone shoplift, let them. Like, you know what I mean?
No, you didn't, right? You see someone, no, you didn't. Like, because what? It's stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, you know, what the news is reporting is like, oh, these horrible looting, crime. People are just ready to be evil. And of course, it's always very specific people. But the mist is a glimpse into a vision of the disaster society that authorities dream of. Because what has been discovered in those, by those in the disaster studies field, as well as writer Rebecca Solnit, is that in times of crisis, people do not wait for authorities to get things back in line, but instead quickly work to support and help one another. They just, like, hop right in, because of course. In her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, Solnit describes them as disaster utopias, citing incidents such as 9/11, where civilians were seen helping others get to safety. The TikTok user even explains, like, you know, helping wheelchair users get down the stairs, like, even at the risk of their own lives, long before the first responders arrived, which is, like, they're also amazing. Everyone was amazing, but there was already people doing the work at the time that don't get the same acknowledgement, right? Hirschberger,
because people think, like, you're going to, like, trample over everybody. Like, we got to get down, so don't save anybody. And they did the opposite of that. So,
well, let's think, why does the plane have to tell you to put your own mask on before you help somebody else? Because it's your instinct to help somebody else. Yeah. Because you're like, but of course you can't help them if you're dying. So, but it's our instinct to... So Hershberger, the TikTok user, also goes on to explain the Manhattan boat lift incident, in which civilians with boats from New Jersey, Staten Island, and other neighboring areas achieved a bigger rescue than that of Dunkirk in World War II, where they just, all these regular people came, took their boats, and tried to rescue people from Manhattan from this horrible thing. So it's just like, people just show up. Like, that happens quite often, right? Solnit explores how the only ones this narrative of disaster society serves are those already in control, enforcing these horror scenarios in which the world is plunged into chaos if left unattended, allows them to swoop back in and regain control. It's like, oh, the world's going to be so crazy. Let us come in here. Let us get in here and fix it all up. Because you guys are like, you can't do it yourself. Like, you need help. We need to hold your hand.
What's wild is, like, in reality, if you see a military person in an apocalypse scenario, you run from them because in every show, like The Last of Us, for example, the military people, if you thought you were going to go get help, they murdered you because it's easier to take care of a small group than a big group. Mm-hmm. So don't go to the military or anyone else. Like, talk to your neighbors who you've known for a while. You know what I mean?
And I mean, those in power have always used time of crisis to push their control further. If you just think about 9/11 specifically, what is a little bit of our securities and our privacy when we can protect everybody? Yep. Like, we can give up those. You can give up a little of that. You can give up Patriot a little of that.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, Snowden's like, it's okay until... something else happens and you're like, none of that really mattered. But, so there, like, it is benefiting a very specific, group of people.
Doubt and fear are powerful tools of the oppressor.
Yes. I was saying, like, to Mike, I was just like, it is like a George Orwell, dream. Yeah. It's like, you instill fear. What I referred to as a George Orwell dream was actually hustle culture. It's like, because you convince everyone to be like, working is cool, working hard
we love this,
is awesome,
like, you know, I haven't seen my family in 2 weeks. I'm loving it. I'm getting that money,
catching a bag, you know, like, that Orwell would be like, what are, like, I couldn't have wrote that, it's so much better. Orwell would also, like, agree with this, it's the better, right? So, in an article on Alta Journal Online titled Rebecca Solnit Considers Disaster Utopias, writer Anita Felicelli enforces Solnit's understanding of the strength of our communities without authority, saying, early in the book, for instance, she disarms us with the story of a blackout in New York City in 2003 that revealed the Milky Way, long hidden from view by light pollution. Far from serving as a source of panic, the blackout becomes a metaphor for the brief utopias that bloom after disaster, showing humans what they could be to one another. Solnit explains that the current social order is something akin to this artificial light, another kind of power that fails in disaster. She doesn't see our hierarchical stratified social order as inevitable. It's human-made, which means we can unmake it too. Which is like... finding this, I'm like, I'm gonna read this book, it's on my list now. I've read a little bit, but I was like, this is so hopeful. We don't really get a lot of that, especially with us being in horror and covering that. It's kind of nice.
Nice for me to hear. Like, when we watched that one movie, it was like the meteor comes.
Oh yeah,
don't look up, and how, like, that was just so devastating, and like, you kind of need hope to facilitate change. Otherwise, like, people are just going to freeze in, like, a permanent executive dysfunction out of how overwhelming the battle is, you know?
And it's just, like, to see something like that, right? Like, to equate this authoritative power structure as the light pollution that...
Yeah.
If it were gone, imagine the Milky Way. Imagine the whole system we could see and we could flourish under were we not shadowed by this overarching power.
That's so beautiful.
All right, me and Soulmate, we're going to write some books together. Anyway, Soulmate reasons that we have a much stronger connection to our community and are innately capable of activism in support of our neighbors versus the innate violence that came. Yeah. Totally blanking out his name. Frank. King and Frank. Believe in. So we have a desire and need to care for each other. And as Kat explained in our Swarm episode recently, we're hardwired for connection. What keeps us from that free connection and support is an authoritative minority that wields the messages, keeping us obedient. These forces, like King, thrive on a narrative in which humans are vulnerable and selfish. Right? He wouldn't sell all those books and wouldn't be so scary if we didn't believe that. Because we do. Bellicelli argues that Solnit believes strongly in humanity's potential, saying if people know how to strengthen the social fabric with moral action in such instances, why is it so challenging to create a society in which we can make sure neighbors are given shelter and food and civic love predominates? In one of Solnit's disaster utopias, the monsters in the mists would be no threat at all. We can envision an alternative ending to one so notoriously grim, one in which the neighbors of the small town work together to reinforce the windows and doors and hunker down until help arrives. In this utopia, Brent and David are able to put aside their differences and work together to protect their home and neighbors. But more importantly, in this utopia, I never have to see a man disintegrate into a million spiders and my nightmares forever.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at.
What a true nightmare that was and will forever be.
Yes.
No, honestly. And it's like, there's so much to it that was stressful, but also it's like the, having the hope aspect, like in a world where one, we don't have to even see the man disintegrate into spider because we stayed inside.
Yeah.
First.
We didn't leave.
And also, like, I get, like, in the film, they're calling out, like, the hypocrisy of some religious people who are like, God, 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 but then also are like, murder him. Maybe we'd also see, like, a world in which she was doing a little less. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, she wouldn't have seemed so right. Because that's the thing, too. And that's something I see with King is, like, at one point when it was, like, she didn't die. Like, there's moments where she should have, and she didn't. And I was like, so is it really, is it God? Because it could be. And I was like, it's getting a little too M. Night Shyamalan here. it's getting a little too spiritual. It's getting a little too...
I think it was a coincidence. She stood still so the bug didn't sting her. The other girl was, like, flapping at it and, like, trying to hit it. So, like, of course, it was a threat. She was like, I'm chill. Don't eat me. And it was like, all right, cool. I think it was a coincidence. And she just used it like a series of coincidences to convince people that more like high level stuff was going on. Like,
that sounds like the Bible, series of coincidences.
Yeah. But like, yeah, like, and like in reality, if they were actually like following some of the things that they claim to believe, that they probably wouldn't be like, go murder these people. They'd be like, yes, of course, give food to everybody, take care of everybody.
Be as Jesus.
The intent of religion initially, before it got all scary and weird, was to like build community and like take care of each other and like have good stuff going on. And it's like transformed, or it has been, honestly, many times. It transforms at times into these horrifying, like, real dangerous situations in which they're like, we use our religion to justify the murder of people. And I was like, that's
well,
a lot.
It becomes a source of power, right? So it's just like the other authorities that we see that spring up in these times of need. That's just another version of it, right? It's just that they have a different, like, you know, platform that they're standing upon. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the same, like, message, right? It's just like, follow me. I know what's right for everybody, and what's right for everybody is that we get rid of all the ones we don't want, the ones who don't listen to us. They're not
Yeah, it was like that meme you sent me the other day where it's like the train analogy or the metaphor. And it's like, oh, I solved it. I just murdered the person who kept tying everybody to the tracks. And I was like, exactly.
It's over.
That's all you're going to do.
Because that's what the trolley problem answer is. Get rid of the person. Putting people on trolley tracks.
Yeah. So that would be the solution. That's why, like, halfway in the beginning of the film, I was like, oh, she's dangerous. You need to get rid of her.
Yeah.
And then I was right. You definitely should have got rid of her earlier. I don't know. But it's fine. It is what it is. At the end of the day, this film was a lot. It made me realize my fears that I thought I had weren't what I thought I had. Like, I'm not scared of the ocean. Not really. No. What I'm really scared of with every fiber of my being is exploding into a pool of spiders. That is my new fear unlocked forever.
It's everyone's fear now.
As well as my, I do not want to survive spider-based apocalypse. Absolutely not. Especially giant acid-slinging spiders that lay eggs in your entire body while you're still alive. Absolutely not. Kill me immediately. And what's really interesting about this, because, like, honestly, if I survived, I would never emotionally recover if I saw a man melt into spiders. Yeah. You would not be able to convince me the rest of my life.
I'm still not recovered.
I'm not filled with spiders now.
And it was on the TV. And
yeah.
I'm not recovered.
I was in this scenario in which I saw the man dissolve into spiders. I was near the spiders. I'm not aware of everything all the time. They could have laid those eggs in me. I wasn't paying attention. Yeah. Absolutely not. I'm for the rest of my life convinced I am of spiders. You need to murder me.
Yeah. Yeah. I gotta go.
Yeah. So before watching this film, I don't think I'd ever seen an apocalypse scenario that I was absolutely fine with dying in the first 3 seconds of. I did not need to make all the 4 days. I usually think like, oh, I'm going to survive or I'm going to try, you know, I'm not usually like, oh, immediately murder me. You know what I mean? I'm usually like, I'll like see what's up with living a little bit more, with this. Absolutely not. But it is a relief, to know that this apocalypse probably wouldn't take place. Not just like the spiders. I mean, maybe the spiders could happen, but as Gabe outlined very nicely, people aren't going to be doing this. So that part's nice.
We also probably won't unlock like another dimension. You know, we won't bring the upside down to the right side up. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
I don't know. They're finding stuff in space, Gabe.
No.
Probably not spiders, but maybe other things that are terrifying.
Cthulhu monster.
As Gabe said, just because this specific scenario probably isn't going to play out, it's not to say there aren't people out there who would absolutely use the apocalypse as a staging ground for their darkest desires to enact violence and control. But as Gabe said, people already are going to do that. They might be a little more slick about it, but people are already doing that right now. But we have like the really nice light pollution to obscure our view from said things. And basically, the argument that we land in and that I'm going to kind of reinforce is that the people who are going to be trying to do that are in the minority. The people who are probably not going to be doing that are in the majority. So if we're following Assassination Nation logic from way back when, 10% of people are good, 10% people are bad, 80% are in the middle, but can be inspired to either direction. And if we're looking at it that way, like 90% of people have the capacity to be good, which is a lot. You know, that's a lot of humans. And the important piece is which direction people are inspired to follow. And I read the same part of the same book that Gabe was talking about, Paradise Built in Hell, by Rebecca Solnit. And it honestly says just that. It reinforces the idea that the direction people are inspired to follow really matters. And that, like, in belief and thinking people are going to do good and acting in the way you want other people to act matters. It's going to influence what's happening, as well as like the fact that we are inherently connected. It all kind of ties back. So Solnit reinforces the idea that the direction people are inspired to follow really matters by saying belief lags behind, and often the worst behavior in the wake of calamity is on the part of those who believe that others will behave savagely and that they themselves are taking defensive measures against barbarism. From the earthquake that shattered San Francisco in 1906 to flooded New Orleans in 2005, innocents have been killed by people who believe were asserted that the victims were the criminals and they themselves were the protectors of the Sheikh in order. Beliefs matter. So ultimately, this take suggests that society has an influence over our perception of what's good and bad and what that can be. Morality, as much as people would argue is objective, is scientifically, from an anthropological standpoint, subjective to the individual group, etc. So someone's understanding of justice will influence how they act in an emergency scenario. So it is in all of our best interests to believe that people are going to do good. Because that belief will spread. So belief in our fellow humans can also influence this. So if we're believing that people are going to be horrible and murder everybody, then like we're going to be on the defensive, we're going to be less likely to trust each other, and that's just going to perpetuate this kind of distrust that lands us in a situation of not being safe.
It's like what we saw in the film.
Exactly. And the belief about humans being bad is something that media honestly perpetuates, and is something that media uses to reinforce our allegiance to the oppressor. And because of that is dangerous. So like, honestly, this film, as scary as it was, is trying to position something kind of dangerous, as a lot of zombie movies do as well. And it like, basically, it's just another instance of media perpetuating mistrust of humans around us that reinforces our desire to isolate from each other, which is like not our inherent way of being. It's oriented or motivated entirely by fear. And if you fear people, it's going to really like influence whether or not you're going to survive these disaster scenarios, honestly.
It's like propaganda.
It is 100%. And it was very entertaining propaganda. I will give it that. I was scared the whole time. It was arguably a good movie.
Yes. But it was a very good horror.
It was a very good horror movie. But is it doing something it shouldn't be doing? I don't know. So the media we consume influences our perception of other people and can either be used to unite us or divide us. So essentially, this can transform by how connected you are to people within your community. So many communities are already built with the understanding of looking out for one of another, with committees and people within it that act as inspiration to the people who live there to follow that understanding. Like, we take care of each other. It takes a village. Like, we're going to look out for each other in situations every day, but also in instances of disaster. So if you're like me and don't know any of your neighbors and actively avoid talking to anyone you don't already know, this might help motivate you to establish lines of connection to people around you, in that it is the people around you that make survival in these scenarios possible. It's basically motivation to like go outside and make friends. Because I was like, I'm not going to go make friends because people are trash and I don't want them to come murder me. They don't want them to know who I am because they can't murder what they don't know. Intense and irrational thing. But this has actually showed me like, maybe not. Isaiah's right. I need to say hi to the neighbors when they're outside.
Yeah. Talk to your block captain.
I don't know if we have that. We have a man who thinks he's the mayor of our block, but I don't know if he actually is.
To talk to him though.
But yeah, essentially it is the people around you that make survival possible, and it's motivation to basically establish connections and build spaces of camaraderie that create a sense of care for each other, because that ultimately will increase your chances of surviving a kind of scenario in which disaster unfolds. So Solnit continues to say, the argument against such keeping in terms of like looking out for each other is often framed as an argument about human nature. We are essentially selfish, and because you will not care for me, I cannot care for you. I will not feed you because I must hoard against starvation, since I too cannot count on others. Better yet, I'll take all your wealth and add it to mine. If I believe that my well-being is independent of yours or pitted against yours, it basically will justify my conduct as natural law if I decide not to help you, if I decide to do harm. Because survival of the fittest, man. Yeah. It's capitalism's slogan.
Telling you, Orwell loves this stuff.
Yeah, if this whole idea sounds familiar, it's because much of our understanding of capitalism is built on that thought alone. In terms of its individualistic thinking and the survival of the fittest, super ableist, gross mentality. And the media we usually see surrounding the apocalypse generally suggests that capitalism and the harsh, cruel way it operates is inherent to us. It is who we are as humans. Humans just do that, you know?
Yeah.
We are, it is built into human nature. We are inherently trash.
Yeah. Quoted Stephen King.
Yeah. Especially, and they like make it sound so inevitable, and in that like even in the deconstruction of this society, humans will lean into capitalism and that way of being without the oppressive structures that exist.
And then you have Octavia Butler, who created Acorn. You're like, oh, wait, maybe not.
Yeah, no. Oh, my God, I love Acorn. If ever religion would have gotten me, it's that one.
Yeah, 100%.
But yeah, so like, it really perpetuates the idea that even in the deconstruction of capitalism, we would still operate as capitalists in a destroyed society. And the book actually positions the opposite, which is honestly where I'm at now, that even though I wasn't sure that their intention was like, I am anti-capitalist now. it might be, I don't know. I didn't read the whole thing yet, but I will eventually. And basically it goes on to say that we could have a reality in which that's not the, what everyone just thinks is the inherent way to be. It creates and inspires a reality where we are not doomed to capitalism forever. As it said, there's a system, but we made it so we can unmake it.
In fact, it has not been this forever. Always been this. It's been this for a very short time. And we can say that didn't work and we can move on. Try something new.
Absolutely. And like with this outlook, there's like a lot of hope for that. And I think a lot of apocalypse scenarios don't provide that hope. It's like, yeah, people are just going to do that. We don't even need capitalism at the end of the day because people are going to keep doing individualistic thinking and just like murder each other and like hoard resources. That's just what people do. And it's not. Ultimately, a lot of science says that like and like records of humanity doing stuff say that that's actually very much not the case most of the time. In fact, it's argued that to act in this individualistic and selfish way where we reject protecting each other often creates a world where every day becomes a social disaster, which honestly, living in capitalism is. And when in reality, while sometimes disasters intensify this, sometimes it provides a remarkable reprieve from it, a view into another world for our other selves. So like, since we're watching Severance, and I know we're going to talk about it eventually, but it made me immediately think of that. Where, but like in a good way, where the other world is like nice. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a happy place where the world is different and we don't got to be dealing with this anymore. So honestly, I was really thinking about that. And I was like, we really saw some of this play out during the pandemic, specifically where many community groups, families and neighbors worked together to uplift each other, build like pods, like co-parented, like found ways to build educational support, systems of care, food resources, et cetera. Like lots of communities banded together to help each other. Family units became more connected and realizing that being home and away from work was more meaningful and like where they wanted to be, to the point where like people don't want to be at work as much anymore.
They don't want to go back.
Because they're like, oh my God, work means nothing. Family, community and connection actually mean a lot. And as the author kind of like positions that like these disasters provide us with a window into like what life could be without these oppressive systems, because you get to slow down and actually look at everything in a way that you haven't been able to before. You're able to like,
they've been distracting you.
Yeah. The light pollution is gone and you're able to like actually like look at your neighbor and be like, wow, I actually care about them. You know what I mean? So yeah, when many people slowed down enough to be able to see what was actually happening around them, they also noticed like a lot of things weren't cool. and we even saw a slight shift in our government providing aid that was previously claimed was impossible in the pandemic through like stimulus checks, increases in welfare programs, healthcare, unemployment supports that they were like, oh, we just don't have the money for it. And in reality, we're like, oh, look, money isn't freaking real. And we could have just been helping people this whole time.
Think about all the accessibility.
Who assesses consequences? Like, who decides?
Yeah.
There doesn't need to be, ultimately, because we're the one who made the stupid system.
Yeah.
But yeah, inversely, we did see companies exploit already vulnerable populations to expand their own wealth. But as the author says, both exist and both show the great capacity for good the majority of people have, as well as the true face of a small minority of people who are pulling the strings to do bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And the book continues to really position the power of belief and how it influences our action as humans. It also provides many anecdotal and like experiences of people building strength and community in times of government and media absence. So very opposite of what we see in The Mist. Mm-hmm. And the takeaway being that if we were to truly believe that humans will act as they do in The Mist, it'll more likely play out that way. But if we instead choose to believe and inspire kindness and care, most people will return that energy. And honestly, that sounds way better. Mm-hmm. Same then spider dissolve time. Absolutely not. Yeah. Like, we could have just had a nice vacation from work in the store for a few days. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, I don't have to go. I'm watching From, which is a show on Prime Video, and Evil Corp. Speaking of minority with too much power, but the whole show is like this weird ragtag like community, and there's something that's sinister that's happening. But everyone's just like, this is an example of a community in which like people are going to work, right? Like there's a diner or someone's tending to the animals, but there's no money. There's like, you know, 30 to 50 people in this little town that is constantly under threat. And they work together. They're not, and it's not because, oh, I'm gonna like get money for it. It's, I'm doing this because we need to survive, and I can help. Yeah. This is the way that I can help and support my community.
And so, like, people are like, who would do jobs if we didn't pay people to do jobs? And I was like,
people have been doing jobs forever.
Yeah, like people would just do the jobs that need to be done so that everyone survives. The benefit is survival.
Yeah.
Well, they would like, do it better. You get to have generations. Great. That is the reward. That should all the reward that is necessary.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah. They just get to survive. They get to live their life. Yeah. They'll do it good and well.
And like it to be happy. Oh, no.
Can't have that.
You get to sit in the sun. Oh, the worst. You get to have hobbies.
Yeah.
You get to see your kids.
Oh,
that's
God.
Why would anyone ever want
thank
that?
Thank goodness
that crazy.
We have these people in power.
Yeah.
These
thank
like
goodness
small
I have to work 9 hours a
1%
day.
1% has all the money. That's so good.
Yeah.
That's very good for us.
Imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. It is.
What if we didn't have to? It would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, it is such an interesting idea that we have essentially created these narratives. Like, we've bought into these narratives as a society and then perpetuated them to the point where it could be detrimental to us in the end because people would just continue to believe that. Sometimes that's all you know about other people is what you're told because you don't go outside. So
yeah.
And I really love that you brought in the pandemic for that section, because it is really true, because, and that's something that we really address even with Don't Look Up, right? It was this, there are people who are, you know, being dumb and being really scary, but they were already scary. They were already dumb. They
exactly.
just were Mrs. just... Carmody, where they their
yeah.
platform was risen, and now they have a bigger megaphone, and people were not already equipped with an understanding of the goodness that people can have. And so they were already expecting, like, of course the government would create a evil vaccine to hurt us, because I mean, honestly, the government has done that. But it's like, you know, we're told that it happens so often and that there's no other, like, there's no alternative, right? It's just people are going to be evil. That's what King wants you to know.
Yeah.
So
that, like, yeah, you got to lock yourself in your house and don't talk to anybody, don't answer the door, et cetera. And it's like, actually, if you help some, now you have people to help you survive longer. Like, they're not a detriment. Like, their success is not your loss. Mm-hmm. And that's something like capitalism, just like, we need to figure out how to deprogram, because it just makes us like pit against each other in a way that's sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what, you know, in our Alice in Borderlands episode, that was something I really appreciated, was because there was a community that found each other, very similar to
yeah.
From where they were working together to work through these these puzzles, and they were surviving. They were more than surviving. They were thriving, right? They were living it, right? The most of the situation they could have versus what you would expect to happen. What we often see in these like post-apocalyptic or disaster scenarios where it's like, oh, everyone's murdering each other. Of course. No, they're not.
It's not of course.
It's not.
We really don't gotta. Like, we could just be nice.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. That all being said, The Mist is a wonderful movie. It is very fun.
Yeah, no, I was not crapping on it. It's just, I was crapping on, like, society thinking society's trash.
Yeah.
That's, like, our thesis mm-hmm. a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So.
But that's what the thesis of horror is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's often, like, society has hurt us a lot. And so we use this as a way to, you know, get that out. But I do think it's important to every now and again remind ourselves that that's not the case. Like, that's one of the things I had to quit listening to true crime, right? Because I was only hearing true crime things or only reading true crime things. And I was like, oh my gosh, people are murdering other people all the time. Like, nowhere is safe. It was really bad and damaging for my mental health until I stopped and was like, most people aren't murdered. Most people are a murderer, and you are safe. Like, I mean, there are dangers out there. Absolutely, you should be aware of them, but they're not only everything, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's also like recognizing the damage of systems versus individual people.
Exactly.
And like, the system is trash. 100%. 100%. That is the enemy.
Yeah.
People, your neighbor, probably not. Like, unless they're really wild, but like most of the time, they're not, you know, like, people are just going to people. And sure, you got to meet people where they are. But it's a system that does it without even people doing nothing. Like, it's the one that doing the things.
Yeah.
Well, it's like murder. I'm just like, cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Even in the film, right? The real bad guys. I mean, like, there was a lot of bad guys. Okay. Mm-hmm. The spiders. Number one bad guy. Number one horrible worst bad guy.
Yes.
The big tentacly elder god, he was fine. He was just hanging out.
he was just walking around town.
Right. The bugs, all those other guys, fine. Spiders, number one. Number two, Mrs. Carmody. Number three, the people who why the bugs were there. Not to spoil it.
Government.
Yeah. but people of power. So, and again, it's just like those narratives, they push them so they can retain power. And it's so.
And at the end of the day, they come save the day with flamethrowers.
Yeah, it's like, you did this. Yay. And I don't care. I don't care that you have flamethrowers because I saw spiders, saw a man bursting into 1,000 spiders. You're going to now use the flamethrower on me. I want this to be over.
I have to go.
I can have a year.
We're done now. It's fine.
Please release me from my spider flesh prison. I need to go.
Please.
Yes.
SOS. We're the same page.
That's the only disaster where I'm like, okay,
Okay, let's go. We don't need to go to the pharmacy. I'm just going to let asthma take me out naturally. And I'm going to go sleep.
I'm going
to go to the big sleep. And just never wake again to spider hell. I don't want to be here.
One of those times when I wish I had something I was allergic to, you know? Oh, fun fact. I'm allergic to spiders.
What? Oh, that's perfect. So you die right away. You don't even survive the egg situation. You're done.
They're like, they bit me, I'm dead. I'm done. Wonderful. Good. I'm a bad host. Hey, spiders. Bad host over here.
Don't lay eggs
in this body. It's not good.
It's
not good. It's got a really bad Yelp review. You don't want it. This is X-Men on the body. Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. You learned some things, and hopefully we're inspired by some things. It's very, very few and far between that we have episodes where we can feel inspired instead of really sad. Which, honestly, this episode could have made us very sad. And when I programmed it...
It could have gone a different way. Absolutely, yeah.
When I programmed it, it was with the intention of, it's going to be really sad.
Yeah.
And I think it's... Like, even in, like, last week's episode with Candyman, like, that was still... It wasn't as bleak as it could have been. Right?
Yeah.
And Swarm 2, I'm finding that we've grown as well as society has grown. And I think that's wonderful. So let us know your thoughts. If you like The Mist, if you read the short story, tell me about it. I'm going to read it soon. And don't get married.
Well, you know, I don't want to say they eat your kids because we want to trust.
Yeah. They won't eat your kids. They'll protect your kids. They'll take care of them.
Yeah.
Ensure that they have all the right
supplies.
Family
unit.
We're going to help each other.
Yeah. That's your partner. So.
I will say that in the film, he didn't raise his kid. He wasn't taking care of that kid. But everybody else in the store was. He had like 7 new parents. All he ever did was run and
cry. It takes a village, Gabe.
It does. And he had a whole convenience store or a whole grocery store. Yeah. To raise him. Good job, boy.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
Bye.